Hello, and welcome to the Development Debrief with Catherine Van Zickel, the stories-based podcast that interviews professionals, donors, and thought leaders in the field of fundraising.
Are you an edge pursuer? Are you interested in joining a mission-driven for-profit company? We offer a truly collaborative and innovative atmosphere where teams take on challenging, industry-leading, sophisticated work while also developing both personally and professionally. If you are smart and creative, hungry for hands-on experience, able to work both independently and as part of a team, and strive to be a great colleague and an exceptional client partner, we hope you'll consider joining our team. Visit bwf.com/careers to learn more.
I am so glad you've tuned into the Development Debrief this week. Jason Briggs and I have a wonderful conversation about everything from Tibetan Buddhism to entrepreneurship. And don't worry, we fit fundraising in there too. He tells us how he decided to make specialist knowledge more accessible through PyroTalks. In fact, Jason Briggs is co-founder of PyroTalks, CIC, as well as consulting partner for BWF Europe and fellow for Halpin in partnership. Previously, Jason was Director of Development at Cavendish Cancer Center, leading on all income channels. While Jason was at the University of Sheffield, he headed up their research and insight function, raising the value of their prospect pool value from £4.2 million to £62.5 million, and sat on the Senate's Academic Research Ethics Committee. He also worked as a consultant at Grand Pelton, specializing in campaign planning. Jason was awarded an Insight in Fundraising Award 2016 for his work on international philanthropy and Case Europe Ian Moore Award 2017 for Emerging Development Professional. He holds a first-class degree in history and philosophy and a diploma in fundraising management. Now let's get started.
Okay.
Great. Yeah.
Jason, welcome to the debrief.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I just want to dive right in. We're so excited to have you on our innovation season. I want to go right to the root with you and start with talking about Tibetan Buddhism. I know that these are teachings and beliefs that you hold dear. Would love to hear how you came to this spiritual journey and what it means to you.
Well, Tibetan Buddhism kind of felt like quite a very natural, possibly even reacquaintance, really. I was always very interested in philosophy, even very young, and I read as many books as I could, and although they were good on philosophy, they didn't quite seem to hit the spot. But when I came across Tibetan Buddhism, that was it. You know, it was a very kind of striking moment, like, this is it, this is the kind of thing I've been looking for. Seemed to answer a load of questions. And then, yeah, I had the privilege of meeting some really great teachers over the years, and one in particular, I studied with for 11 years on a weekly basis, and he taught me how to do what they call Tibetan debate, which is a kind of a form of almost like intellectual sparring, a bit like what the ancient Greeks did in the past in their universities, but I'd say a lot more advanced, really, than that in a non-critical way. They just, there's a whole other level to how they do their debate. And so I got attracted to that, and I did that, done that weekly now pretty much for 11 years, and this person was one of five Westerns ever to complete a full Tibetan monastic training. So it's a kind of a rare person to have this relationship with, but it's been really beneficial.
So I want to go back to what you said. When you found it, you thought, this is it. What does that mean? Like, what about it made it it?
Yeah, it was two things, really. One, it just seems to answer a lot of questions. And it didn't seem to have many loose ends. That was what I felt was good about it. They seem to really have quite a satisfactory answer for lots of things. Yeah, and then the other one really was what I found when I was studying things like philosophy was I didn't necessarily even think the people that were teaching it, these lecturers, although very knowledgeable, were not particularly happy people or very sociable people. It just, some weren't. And I don't know, what I felt there was like a gulf between the philosophy and their own character, you know, and their own heart, maybe. And I felt like Tibetan Buddhists, and they would probably say this themselves, that they're experts at getting the philosophy, if you like, into the heart rather than the head. And they just have all these techniques and meditation, contemplation, whatever. And I think, you know, over time, the point is to craft your character in a certain direction. And I think they knew how to do that. And that's what I found really inspiring. It's very practical. Yeah.
Well, I think we all know that most people bring their whole selves to work. And so if this is a huge part of your life that you're doing weekly and practicing weekly, and I'm sure thinking about every day, I'm fascinated by the Tibetan debate piece. And I wonder if that's helped you at all in your work.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot, I would probably say, in various different ways. I mean, just in a more practical way, at a fairly young age, my first fundraising projects, if you like, one way or another, were around Tibetan Buddhist projects. So yeah, that gave me some kind of straight up practical access to even the concept of fundraising. You know, there were many charities that run these teachings and so forth, so that was good. But in terms of actually what further does it bring? Well, the debate is exceptionally analytical, and there's only at each possible moment, there's only two answers you can give. And I have to take a lot of explaining as to why, but we don't need to know that. And also it's exceptionally rigorous and very kind of quite active. So the defender who's defending a certain point of view sits on the floor, and the challenger stands up and stands over the person, and they challenge you with their kind of views on things or wrong views, and you've got to successfully defend them as best you can. And I think that analytical side helped me a lot with prospect development, prospect research, because a lot of that side of fundraising is very process driven. I think it helps you to see like the gaps in the process, or how things can link up, or the nuance to data, you know, as well, like how these overlap and how they should behave together. If that happens and this happens, then this should be happening elsewhere, you mm-hmm. know, and it's that kind of thing that I think it really helped with. But the other one I would say is, the last thing I would probably say on that is, I think it made me very open to other views. Because literally what you do into the Tibetan debate is you start in one school of thought, and then you keep moving up these different schools. And the point is, it's the last school, if you like, that has the correct view of reality, as they would call it. But you've got to go through these schools first, which are considered wrong views or incorrect or whatever. And you've got to defend them and do your best to defend them successfully. And what you see over time is the gaps in their knowledge and why X or Y is wrong. And you don't just know that anymore. You can't just say to someone, oh, you're wrong, you know, and just because I think you're wrong. But you know why, you know, you really see it. And also you see their strengths. And I think that's what it enabled me to feel like. I've always felt very accommodating of different points of views, different sectors, where people are coming from. And I think, especially managing teams, never mind developing new projects. I think that was useful tool, things like consulting too, you know, meeting people where there may be a bit of a divide in the office, and you've got to kind of come to the solution together. And it's been a big part of my life, beneficial. Yeah.
And sounds like it's helped a lot of people too. You've shared it along the way.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I want to shift gears a little bit and bring up something that you've told me before, which is you think the sector is inward looking. I thought that comment was really striking. To a certain extent, I really do agree with that. And I thought that was sort of a innovative comment, that you think we're inward looking and that you'd like for us to be more outward looking. So let's talk about that. When did you first start feeling that way?
I think I started feeling that way the more I felt I'd almost, if you like, finished my training, or not finished my training, but had embarked on what was available. If you know what I mean, the training courses for, say, things like prospect development or even fundraising, as I kind of identified who the providers were, like your central statutory bodies or whatever, chartered this, that, and they were in the UK with the Chartered Institute of Fundraising, and obviously this case. And, you know, as I went through those, I think that's when I started to become aware of what I felt the sector was quite inward looking. Yeah. And I guess what I mean by that is, of course, on an individual level, people, you know, could trade in all kinds, and they do trade in all kinds. But as a sector, it felt like it was continually reinventing the wheel, which had probably been successfully invented elsewhere, if you know what I mean. And I've got some examples in my mind, like charity brand, for example. Reputation is notoriously sensitive for not-for-profits. One step wrong and you can lose a huge amount of income in fundraising. And we've been trying to manage that ourselves, charity brand, due diligence processes, ethics and reputational risk. But there's a whole sector out there called Reputation Management, and they've been there, done that, got the t-shirt, you know. And I think because we felt we're different, we feel like fundraising is different. And I agree with you, some parts of it very much are, but it's almost like that sense has held us back from absorbing other sectors and their understanding and their own pieces of knowledge. So like reputation management or prospect research, it might be, say, business intelligence teams. All companies, big companies have them. You know, how do they do their data work? How do they do their thinking? Major give fundraising, you know, we almost have a bit of a sneer towards the idea that we're sales, but they could teach some insanely good things. And there's read a book at the moment about a negotiator and what he can teach. And you know what I mean? There's like all that kind of stuff out there. And yes. How do we absorb it? Yeah.
I think that where that comes from is that we all feel like our institutions are so unique. And so we have these unique histories and sets of leadership. And so we should do things differently. And yes, of course, we should acknowledge what makes us individual and our own. But yeah, the basic concepts can be applied across the board. And so I think you're right. And I think that we are starting to be more outward with podcasts coming out and more conferences, more sharing, more of a public platform. But what do you think are other ways that we can be more outward?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, this is where my whole endeavor with Power Talks has come from, you know, and has been this kind of effort on, well, how do we do that? How do we answer that question of becoming more absorbent or having more, I don't know, interaction with other sectors, and how do we benefit? And that's, that's where a lot of my focus has been. Yeah, I mean, how do you actually go about it? Well, I guess we could come on to that topic, but I guess it's quite simple things, isn't it, really? Like reading other books or going to external training as much as we can and remaining open. But yeah, come back to that. I've got some thoughts on that.
Well, that was the perfect transition because, of course, we want to spend some time talking about Pyro Talks. So assume our listeners have no idea what it is. Let's hear the breakdown of what Pyro Talks is and why you started it.
Yep, great. Well, I guess in a summary, the kind of tagline for Pyro Talks is making specialist knowledge more accessible. That's the kind of, if you like, the tagline. And I set this up 2 years ago with someone called Jonathan Jeffrey, and he's an associate dean at the University of Sheffield Management School. And he's got 18 years experience in the business and financial world, the knowledge and trading and lecturing and author as well. And when I was a researcher and we were obviously researching all these prospects and fundraisers were approaching them, I always felt there was a total blind spot in how we assess prospects and how we react to business news. Do we even know what stocks and shares are? We talk about it, but do we even know what they are and what's all the facets to them and the best way to use them? And I know we have definitely grown in that area, but there's even misunderstandings that have held our knowledge back, like thinking that if you've got negative profit in a company, you can't be successful. Well, in that case, you know, say goodbye to Telson on Twitter. They've never made a profit, but they can be very successful. And it's those kind of things. And so Pyro Talks was set up with that intention, first of all, was to make business and financial knowledge of that world more accessible. And so we've done a course on that called Masterclass in Business and Financial Analysis for Philanthropy. And we did the first one last year. We had 105 professionals on. It was really good. And John led that. We had some guest speakers and we had fundraisers and researchers, directors, a whole mixture. Yeah. Went through the journey and yeah, it was great. And so, yeah, that's what we do, focus on making that kind of knowledge more accessible along with due diligence. And we also do what we call a nano conference. And this is kind of rethinking about the way we actually absorb knowledge. And the nano conference is about 90 minutes long. And all the speakers and all the talks do 6, 12 or 18 minutes. So it's really sharp bursts of knowledge. Yeah, and we make sure as well, this whole thing about the sector, we make sure that about 50% of the speakers are from outside the sector and about 50% of the speakers are from inside the sector. And that's only really achievable through this online kind of format. Yeah.
That's not something we do often. Like I had a salesperson on the podcast. I've had a communications expert. Yeah. Why don't we hear from those people more often?
Yeah. They've got some great things to say. Yeah. Yeah.
They do. They do. So it sounds like you had a really successful year last year doing this and sharing the knowledge. It sounds like I need to go to one of them, is my takeaway on that.
Yeah, well, you'd be very welcome. Yeah.
But beyond sharing the information, is there a goal beyond that to have more success in our fundraising work, or is it something else? How do you think about it?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's to become more effective in what we've been calling big philanthropy, you know, in those bigger gifts, making organizations achieve stability better. And because their intel or intelligence, like business intelligence, is sharper, you know, and the fundraisers are more prepared. Like DiGiudo, for example, at various different times of the year, that, you know, companies are literally more wealthy. And why? And what do they want to do with that? Well, often they want to spend a bit of money because they will get taxed on it. So like at the end of a year in a department, you've got a budget. What do they tell you to do? Spend it or lose it. And it's that kind of thing. That kind of thing exists in companies too. And well, can we identify those moments and give fundraisers that direction, therefore, to maybe make some asks around the times where the prospects and companies are feeling a bit more successful and those kind of things. So really targeting
that savvy, you know, you're talking to them as a peer because you know what they're going through. You're not just completely unaware of their circumstance. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And how this, the whole mid-level as well, the prospects, which can be quite difficult to research. How do we access them? Because there's a lot of individuals out there that can give quite significant gifts, but they're not right on the top echelon of society, if you like. I mean, all these public companies that we see, your big Apples and Telstra's and all that, they're on the public stock market. But apparently, from my research, I think it's forgotten which report it was, they said only 2.5% of individuals become wealthy through working up the ranks of big companies. So everyone else is making their money really through these kind of mid-level, small to private organizations. And yeah, how do we understand that world a bit better as well?
And with your research background, you probably have ideas about this, but we were actually just talking about it earlier in the office. People who are very good at hiding their assets or using LLCs or family foundations, do you address that at all in Pyrotox?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And that's, in fact, we've got a special module on the new masterclass that starts in April of this year. We've got a thing called Identifying Hidden Prospects. And how do we do that? And yeah, it's definitely things you can do, inferences and so forth. And that was kind of my point. Like when I was at Sheffield, I felt really stuck and I couldn't get necessarily the right answer on some of these really nuanced questions. And that was actually where I met John for the first time. He was a lecturer there. And I asked him to come to the department to do a bit of a talk for us. And that's how we got to know each other. And years later, I circled back around and say, look, I think there's quite a big gap here. There's some really good stuff going on as well. But, you know, you could add a lot of value to a lot of teams in the not-for-profit world. You know, shall we run this thing, like, and we end up calling it Power Talks? And, yeah, it's been great. And for him as well, he's really started to use his knowledge in a way he never thought he could, which is help not-for-profits.
So you've empowered him.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, we kind of... I've got the fundraising and I direct his brain towards fundraising, but it's his brain that has all the useful bits of information.
How did you come up with the word pyro?
It was a difficult one. We literally come up with loads of names. Maybe you thought this was your podcast and we kept searching for them. And it so happens there was something called that. Then we tried another name. It so happens there was something called that. So in the end, I don't know. I think we just built like a little chart and we almost ended up coming up with just like, well, that sounds nice. But then we thought, okay, well, where do we learn the most? Or where have you had some of the best conversations or the best talks, you know, around a fire, you know, and it's like pyro talks means fire and so forth. So we were trying to reach for those kind of things.
Very cool.
Yeah.
It sets a nice tone too, that it's a place that's safe and there's comfort there, but you can ask questions and have that dialogue. So that seems very fitting.
Yeah, definitely. Like we chose the word talks deliberately, really. So it feels a bit more open-hearted as opposed to like presentations or, you know, where it feels a bit more serious or lecture, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Do you find that your audience is international? Like, do you have...
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I should have said that. It really is kind of a global, really. It is almost 50-50 UK and US. And then we've got a whole sprinkle of different countries that kind of come through, you know, Israel, Finland, India, Indonesia. That's so amazing. It's a good mixture, yeah.
And how does BWF fit into all of this?
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, I was thinking about when we're, well, you know, you gave some of these questions to think about innovation. And yeah, I think I've always admired Josh Burkholz, the CEO there, and his approach to innovating. I mean, when I go to his talks, he would always mention all these different books that he's read. And I ended up reading some of them and so forth. And I guess, you know, he was already reading from outside the sector and so forth. So I just found it inspiring, and I read his book. I guess that's at the very start of my career that I read his book about data. And in a way, it was a bit of like a realization that you can use data for good. I didn't quite get that back then. And so that was wow. Great.
So that was an aha moment then.
Yeah, 100%.
Facilitated by Josh.
Yeah, yeah. And my task was to set up a prospect management system for the University of Sheffield. And I thought, well, I'd best read around it first, you know, and that's how I came across it. Yeah, and it was really good. So just naturally over time, I think we've ended up crossing paths. And so, you know, he really likes what we've been trying to do at Pyro Talks. They joined our first nano conference, sponsored a few events. We had a big online conference, but 1,000 tickets sold for this one. So it's really big for our first one, so we're very lucky. And yeah, we've done a kind of a few joint surveys together on due diligence, and again, in that knowledge space that hasn't had much visibility or traction. So yeah, it's been great to have BWF support and their innovative streak, definitely. Yeah.
And, you know, PyroTalks isn't the first thing that you've done that's where you've identified a need and then put together a solution. I know that you've done research projects and a couple of other things, but what I want to ask you is, what is it that gives you that confidence to, I mean, I think a lot of people identify problems, a lot of people might come up with solutions, but to actually implement them, you know, I think people would want to hear more about that. Like, how do you take that step? To
yeah.
Take action.
Yeah, it's so interesting, the question, because when I was thinking about us catching up, I've been reflecting on that. I tried to think about myself, and it's quite a difficult thing to answer. And the only kind of things that I could come up with is a feeling. Innovation, I feel like, is driven by a feeling that is kind of a mix of curiosity and frustration. It's like the two seem to be mixed together. And then from there, you know, you end up with the frustration is, what's the right answer? Can't we do things differently? Can't we do things better or whatever? And the curiosity is all the reading around, trying to find the right answer or many right answers. And yeah, and then putting them together, I guess. And that's the way I feel like the energy of innovation is. But in terms of how do you actually activate it? Yeah, I think what my biggest shift in my life was probably when I did public speaking courses. And it helped in ways that I did not expect in your whole life, really. So there was a time where I had to do a public talk, and basically I bailed last minute. It was a room of, I think it was about 200 students, and I totally freaked out, made up an excuse that I had to leave. I went to lady and said, look, I have to leave. And she was like, what, you're on in 5 minutes? I was like, no, it's an emergency meeting. I've got to go to Leicester. I invented some meeting that I had to go to. And she looked at me very curiously. And I gave her the stuff and I said, oh, thanks very much, can you do it? And then I basically ran out the door, and my office was in a certain direction, but I ran past the window to make it look like I was going to the train station, and then circled all the way back round and just put my head in my hands on my desk. And it was because I was terrified of public speaking, you know, and it was at that moment that I realised I had to do something. And I went back and did it the next year, but I started to go to a speakers club, and that just drew everything out. And I think, if people do have that kind of feeling that they might want to do a blog, or they want to do a talk, or they want to do something, then public speaking courses are brilliant for it. They help you just get getting used to standing up. And what you start to realize in particular, I think, is it doesn't matter if it flops or you get it wrong. So if you stall on a talk or your mind melts down a little bit, nothing happens. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nothing. And so you're all right.
Yeah.
And then that starts to make you think, oh, okay, then if you write a blog then and it tanks, so what? you know, and it's like, so I think it gives you the freedom to try it. But I did that for years, about 5 years. I went every month to a speakers club, and it was great. And you learn about so many other people through it as well and their lives. And highly recommend that if someone is feeling like they've got these ideas, but they want to draw it out.
I mean, I can totally relate to that. I remember the first two or three episodes that I published, like when I pressed the button for it to go live, I had this like incredibly anxious, fearful feeling of like, what's going to happen now? You know, it's out in the world. What's going to happen? And well, nothing happens, right? Yeah. I mean, that's very cool. To help people get over that, what I'm hearing from you is that when you kind of face your fear and step into that space, it expands. And there's so much more that will happen and grow and bloom as the result of sharing your passions.
Definitely, yeah. And I feel like you kind of gain a bit of, it's like a kind of confidence as well. And like, for example, like when people say, oh, did I look nervous when I did that talk? Because I was terrified. They just say things like, no, you didn't look nervous. You look totally fine. And it's just that weird disconnect between the way you're feeling about what you're doing and the way the world is. Half the time, well, the most of the time, everyone's wrapped up in their own things, you know. So, but we worry so much about what people think. And I think that's a bit of a trap. You may have felt this when you start to do your podcast. Is my error at the beginning of say when Empower Talks was kind of getting too wrapped up in what other people are doing, and you're like, oh, you know, how's that training event going, or how's that podcast going, and so forth, or even comments. I mean, we had some really strange funny stuff happen, if you like, when you start something new or whatever. And I think what I learned was another part of the skill that I learned in this kind of launch was to really just go, at some point, it doesn't matter what everyone else is doing. You've got a piece of grass here and you've got to make it as best as possible. And that's it. And that's all your job is. And you might pop your head up every now and then to just kind of get ideas or see what's going on. But really, you shouldn't be spending too much time on that. You should spend as much time as possible making your piece of grass as best as possible. And that helped me, I think, relax when I was running these things. Yeah.
I love that. What do you think we should be warned of? I mean, I think you've just sort of told us your advice in terms of focusing on your own space and being your best self. But what are pitfalls that you've experienced that we could try to avoid based on your wisdom?
You mean for doing innovation or running?
Yes, with innovation and these kinds of projects and, you know, outward thinking.
Yeah, I think that what I just mentioned is quite a big one, getting caught up in what others are doing. And that's a skill to learn how to put that aside and just make sure yours is best as possible, and so forth. But the other one I think people may not do as much as a couple of things. I mean, one is making sure you've got the right people around you. And that's what we did early on with Pyro Talks. We went around to people that we knew and made sure that they would kind of share some of the posts or come on and speak for us. And I think having the right people around you when you're doing these kind of things, a big boost really, and give confidence that what you're doing is worthwhile. I think the other one is as well, there can be, I've read a book, a good part of it called Return on Character, and by a guy called Fred Keel. Funnily enough, that was another suggestion I came across through Josh. And he shows that good character can increase your return on whatever it is by up to 500% if you remain ethical and try to stay ethical. I think sometimes there can be a temptation if you're running your own thing. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing to say, to be unethical, but that's not what I mean. What I mean is try to do the right thing, even if you could be tempted to do the wrong thing, you know. And I think people feel that maybe, and therefore more happy to support you or whatever, or I don't know how to put that into words.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Just being grounded in your beliefs, that people are drawn to that.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, and that goes back to my very first note really on all this. And because I did a talk at the University of Sheffield some years later, and I said in all these kind of space of innovation and running your own thing, you have to be inspired yourself. It can't be a fake inspiration. It's got to be a real one, because that's how people gather around and go on the journey and so forth. And you know, it's got to be inspiration. You might call it even a vision, but you've definitely got to feel inspired yourself, inspired enough so that if you said to yourself, okay, I'm going to earn no money for 2 years, is that going to be okay? Then it should be okay. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That the answer to that question has to be yes, basically. And then inspiration is hopefully strong enough. Yeah.
Jason, thank you so much. I'm going to wrap us up with what do you know for sure?
Yeah, actually, it's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean,
an interesting question for a Tibetan Buddhist too.
Yeah, I thought, you know what? What's the first thing that comes to my my mind really? And what I know for sure is that good people exist. Truly good people do exist out there, and I've had the pleasure of meeting a handful of them in my life. And all I can say is that, yeah, that's the one thing I'm certain of. And I think knowing that brings peace for some reason, a sense of calm or joy or whatever, just knowing that these kind of good people do exist. That's the one thing I might know for sure.
Thank you so much, Jason.
I love Jason's story about public speaking. It's a reminder that we all have things that scare us, but that it's important to forge ahead and not get in our own way. Please connect on social media. I would love to hear from you. And to quote Jason, find your piece of grass and make it the best it can possibly be. Have a great week.